Conference record has joined the conference.
Conference will be starting shortly. started. Donna, please sit down. Hi, Donna. Well, welcome to everybody. We have a pretty good turnout. A couple people had indicated that they wouldn't be able to make this. I know Dr. Shah sent me a note, and Kelly from the conference is on vacation, so Phil will represent their interests. That was sort of a reminder for everybody to please use the microphone when you speak. We sent out the agenda, and I hope people received that. I guess I'd like to start, if it's okay. We have a meeting summary from the last meeting. We're not really formally taking minutes, but if there was anything that struck anybody as an error, or it didn't feel like it was the meeting that you were at, I'd like to just stop a minute and see if there are any corrections or errors in the minutes. Harvey?
Thanks, Mike. I do think we left out, I know there was mention in the last two meetings on state hospital dollars and where they fit into this. I'm not sure they made it to the minutes.
Yeah, I guess let's sort of table that as an item that needs conversation at some point. Lori?
It may be that it's a substitute of the health plan. In the call at the last meeting, I had raised an issue about the perfect case management money, very specifically in terms of questions we had as to how it could be used in this setting. And I was hoping that that could, substitute. And then I wondered that.
There is something, the last bullet on the bottom, where it says existing TCM along with CIDP will keep current rates for 2 years for existing slots. TCM programs will be moved in.
I don't have that.
Okay. This is the meeting summary from July 12th. That's what I'm referring to as. No, I'm just, before we get into the work, I just want to see if there are any, if there are any big problems with the way the last meeting was recorded, that's all.
Under my presentation,
so that would qualify as an actual correction.
We won't lose you yourself, sorry.
Right.
Oh, is that on?
Oh, sorry. In the summary, it refers to my organization as United Health. That is not my organization. It's Emblem Health. A lot of folks from where I come from would be very upset about that. If that could be corrected. Thank you.
But the way it's worded, somebody may have made the point that they saw some data once from United, and
this data was.
But it was in your data, so that should be referred to as Emblem then.
Yeah.
It was part of Eileen's presentation.
Mike, just a point on the minutes. In this section, it talks about. I guess it was the. Section after your presentation where it talks about concerns about the final product. Just wanted to make sure that there was something clearly stated here where we had raised an issue about savings that would be generated elsewhere and the recommendation that we not have to actually cut behavioral health
services. So I think that's actually covered explicitly in the working outline that we'll spend some time on.
Right.
So let's table that for that conversation.
Right, I guess I just want to make sure that it's reflected in the minutes because it was something we talked about at the last meeting.
Yeah, well, we put it in the outline.
Okay.
So.
Gotcha.
So we'll accept the report on the last meeting with those comments and corrections. And you see the outline of the agenda for today. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what we've styled here as a working outline. It's a draft outline for the final report. So we just want to go through that section by section. Linda or I will talk about that a little bit. And we're not making decisions yet on any of this, but we're trying to lead to a sense of the meeting about substantive points for the final report. So we have a good chunk of time from that. As we discussed at the last meeting, we have convened a children's subgroup, and Gail Naoth agreed to lead that. The co-chairs appointed members, disappointing many who were not appointed and probably disappointing some of those who were, but it's really an excellent group, and Gail will give us a little bit of an update. They've already met as a former group at least once, so we'll talk that through. Commissioner Sanchez had wanted to reserve some time to have a specific discussion of issues related to behavioral health management of substance use services, and so she and her staff have prepared an overview that I think Rob Kent will provide. We wanted to take some time, next to last item on the agenda, to talk through where things are at with health homes. The Department of Health is moving very quickly to assemble health homes. Supposedly, an application was going to be made available today, but I don't know that it's posted yet, but very soon. And so this was one where we thought we should, in a sense, stop now and have a bit of a discussion to try to identify a, you know, sort of top half a dozen or top 10 list of recommendations that would represent kind of a consensus from the group that we could pass on to the health department or use ourselves working with them as the that process moves forward. So we have a fair amount to cover, and then we'll talk a little bit about where we are and where we go in terms of next steps. Anything else? Yeah.
Beautiful. We've got a lot to do.
So let's jump in then to the working outline for the final report. So I said this is a draft and only a draft. It's an outline and only an outline. The staffs of at the state and the city level have worked together on this. We've tried to include directly some things that are pretty explicit, like the charge to the committee. So some of that is a direct quote out of other materials. There are a couple areas where we want to add our interpretation of what the charge means or how we are thinking about approaching it. There are two sections of the final report that are not included in this outline because they're in a separate document that you also should have received, the date of 7/29/11 MRT Behavioral Health Group Work Group Principles and Outcomes. So we wanted to have we'll talk about these items when we get to that part on the agenda. These items reflect a synthesis of the sticky dot exercise we did at the first meeting and the conversation we had at the second meeting. So it tries to just organize that material. And then we go on to talk about some other principles and issues that have emerged from presentations. For example, there are a couple things here that relate to the presentation that Eileen made about managed care 101, a few things else that we just sort of gleaned from the presentation so far. So I think we'll just try to go through this. We're not going to be voting. We're not going to be making final decisions, but we want to sort of test in conversation where we're at with this and what do people need added to be are subtracted to be comfortable with the draft.
So maybe if I could jump in, because as I don't know what the social work title would be for a good cop bad cop routine. I agree with everything that Mike said, and time is short, and we have not that much time for many meetings. And so I think what we want to do, we laid this out. I think the outline reflects essentially it's an organizational structure that can turn into recommendations, those things that are principles. And so you should see a lot of parallels. Those things that we articulated as our principles are now laid out as a framework for recommendations. And what we need to do today as we go through this is with everything that Mike says around this being a draft outline and no votes being taken and very tentative in its first outline, we also have the need to sort of move it to the next step because we need to start working. It's really in the details where a lot of the stuff is going to make a difference. And so as in the spirit of all of the open conversation and sort of best thoughts that we can get out, let's try to make our thoughts sort of progress towards closer to a set of recommendations. I think it's, you know, we've done a lot of sort of gathering out. I think it's we're getting close to the time that we can sort of stop bringing in lots of new considerations and start really honing in on what we want to recommend. And I think so the things that I would urge is that as we think about our own comments, we think about the principles that that we've laid out, and we try to I think there's going to be a particular challenge in thinking about New York City compared to the rest of the state and about stewardship of the behavioral health and mental health and substance abuse treatment services in sort of this new world that we're looking into. And so there's my urging. Let's also make our comments in a way that, you know, sort of really as concrete as possible that we can help take a general comment into a closer to a recommendation.
So let me make a concrete suggestion. Let me just take the first two bullets here, the charge and the focus. And I'll take the first of those, and if Linda, you can talk about the second, which gets into city and state issues.
Yeah.
Harvey, before we do that?
No, just reaction to that.
Well, we're going to talk about it more substantively. So
okay.
Just, so and all I have to say about the charge is that this comes explicitly out of the charge given us by the MRT. So this, you know, this is what they told us to do, and since it was their work, not ours, it's copied here. That's the charge. This is consider the integration as well as the integration of these services through the various payment and delivery models, examine opportunities for co-location and peer managed addiction treatment services, provide guidance about health homes, blah, blah, blah. That's the charge. That's what we were told to do. Done. Now, the next area does begin to get into some interpretation of the charge or its direction at the city and the state level. So, Linda, let me throw that to you.
In talking about this, I think we're, I'll go back to sort of my seat at the table. This was part of the conversation in the Medicaid redesign team proper, where in looking at the way that mental health services and behavioral health services have been provided to many fragile populations, the very fragmented system. I think has not allowed the strength of all of our services to have as much benefit for clients as it ought to. So I am a very strong proponent of that kind of integrated behavioral health and physical health service, and I think that's what, in fact, led to the charge here. And what we wanted to quickly move to in the focus is a recognition of the desire for that in New York City, where we believe we have the infrastructure and capacity to achieve that, and then to recognize in the rest of the state where a special need plan may not be capable of being formed to have the a system where integrated delivery service or a BHO will be the backup plan until such time that a full special need approach is capable of being achieved for the rest of the state. And so this first paragraph that's under focus really lays that out with the goal that the fully integrated special need plan would be a set of concerns and issues that need to be articulated in and of itself, and distinct from that would be how the set of recommendations for a risk-based behavioral health organization. I'm learning from Mike and realizing is really going to be critical in our ability to achieve that is to be fully at the table in the preparation of the 1115 waivers that will have to go into the federal government from the state. I understand that it's roughly next spring while there are some conversations going on. And the permissions that we'll need in order to authorize this approach to services all have to be embedded in that plan and need to be reflected in the document that we send to the federal government. And so that's, you know, again, it's just a broad framework, but I think that, you know, it's really within those two paths that we need to refine our set of recommendations. So should
okay.
we pause there for
yeah,
a second?
Yeah, so conversation, this is your point, Harvey?
Yeah, thank you. So it kind of picks up on what John has said last time, which is what is the ultimate consequence of what we do here? And to me, that at minimum, whatever I've heard throughout is, so we're not just making general sort of recommendations that just wind up somewhere on somebody's table. If indeed, you know, the holy grail is what winds up in maybe the waiver or the contracts or the RFPs. Mm-hmm. If it's not in the contract, it doesn't happen. And so all these things that we're talking about are important, but not if they're just, they're not wired into measurable criteria and deliverables. And so I would just, you know, say to you all, and maybe back to the MRT, we should probably stick around and not just end in October and walk this through until we get to a place where it's no longer appropriate because of bidding and legal considerations to follow, to make sure that these general comments are translated into the kind of deliverables we'll be proud of. Yeah. And not feel like...
So I can say for myself as sort of a, I can't say as a private citizen, but with my hat on in terms of my role in New York City government, I very much intend to stick around. And I think the more that we can continue to voice the concerns of this group, now whether
the governor's office will
want to impanel us for longer, our authority lasts up to that point. But clearly, I think two things. One, that, you know, the more clear, specific, and forceful the recommendations are, I mean, they have created us, and so they very much are expecting us to take on our role fully, and so I think it's incumbent on us to be as clear as possible and as forceful as possible. But then, you know, we will develop a lot of relationships from this conversation, and I think the more that we can continue to act as advocates beyond this task, the better.
I guess I'm trying to encourage a recommendation from this group to the MRT that we remain in some organized fashion, not just independently trying to influence it, but actually being on saying, this is what we meant, this is what we'd like to see happen, yes or no.
Yeah, it's just I'm comfortable, I think, with bringing that back. I mean, we didn't appoint ourselves. So,
right.
You know, it's like you sort of can't say, I'd like to not stand for election. I'd just like to run, you know, have a second term. So we actually have to go back to the people who appointed us. But I think you're hearing from us a willingness in doing that. And obviously, if that were to happen, since it would be a re or a new appointment, details might shift. But so but your message fundamentally is continued
you're
involvement.
You're not going to get kicked off in the next version?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are consequences.
But so far you're doing good.
Keep it up. So you have a sense from the co-chairs that a continued role of the group will like it is necessary.
I just would like to say, Linda, I think it's great to frame the issues in the integration in a context of the larger integration question with the physical healthcare. Okay, so. And your use of the word forceful, I think, is appropriate. I think we should be sending a remarkably strong message to the MRT that the savings in physical health care that can be driven by this group demand attention, that this is not just a sort of sub-specialty area that's got to, you know, sort of massage a few things and produce some savings. We can drive significant savings, and then here's how we plan to do it specifically.
Okay,
We will get to that. We're not there yet.
So you are jumping ahead, and which is good. And we you'll see under the second bullet under item two, when we get there, I think we want to maybe think about how to expand it to
okay.
be so that there's no doubt about how the areas in which we're expecting savings and the manner in which they should be reinvested. I think in our conversation and preparing for this meeting, Mike and I discussed that the system itself needs to be stronger in order to achieve the kind of savings the state needs. Mm-hmm. And so if they, and of course all of this was a budget exercise, and so it seems to me that the savings are such that they can achieve their budget savings and there can be reinvestment dollars in order to strengthen the system such that you can get those savings. It's that they're not, I think we need to make the case that you're not going to get the savings if you don't do that reinvestment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Linda, I just have one or two clarifications about what you said. I totally get the notion about the difference in the city and the importance of the city's role and the importance of both behavioral and health. I'm with you all the way. Just as a kind of maybe the next step, as you know, contracts with managed care plans are now with the state health department, not with the localities. I'm assuming that the structure we have for those contracts will continue in this exercise as well.
Well, you too are skipping ahead.
Oh, okay.
So
well,
if you look
right
at the first
up,
bullet, but this
okay.
is good because we'll want to
okay.
come back. The first bullet under item three,
yeah.
and this is, for me, an important point. I believe that the mental health experts at the state level should be managing these plans.
Well, that was my second part of my question. So I was going to, exactly, we're on the same page. I was going to say that just as the health department has the primary regulatory responsibility for plans now, these are special plans, and at the very least, mental health should have either a role or the lead role. But it's, yeah, okay, we're on that.
So, and I think we're saying there, mental health and addiction. So
I am. And
yeah.
whenever I say that, I should probably change
right.
our language to behavioral. Yes.
And so just to make it clear, I'm not sure if there's a way to do that right now, but as Linda said, that's the question that she wants to raise and for us to have a conversation about. Bill?
I'd like to piggyback on Harvey's statement. I think that we're going to be pushed to be making decisions on models and making specific recommendations, and in particular we're talking about the regional framework here, and yet we're going to be finished with our work here at this point before we have any data and information to judge whether or not the regional model even works for anything outside of New York City.
I think we're agreed that we're going to, you know, as every group would like to, but we will with, you know, particular zeal, urge our continuance.
Okay.
And so that we don't know yet exactly how that will play out. The way that I would think about this, we're supposed to be done by October. That is insufficient time to inform two significant next steps. One of those is the development of this mega waiver that the state is talking about. To address health services other than the DD system, which is going to be on its own waiver track, number one. Number two, by that time, we have to be able to know what, if any, recommendations about this need to go into budget language for consideration, you know, for consideration by the Department of Budget in the fall and consideration by the legislature in the spring. And then at some point in the spring, we expect that a waiver to be submitted and the legislature to act on whatever recommendations are made. And then a lot of work is going to have to happen going forward in terms of actual, you know, contracting and so on and so on, maybe regulations. So that's the way I see the time that lies ahead. And then, of course, the other thing is that the operation of the interim BHOs will start up, you know, in the fall, and there is going to need to be some oversight of them. So that's another reason to have some group charged with taking a look at that. So we're on board to recommend continuation of the group, and I just took a little diversion off, or you know, digression to what the likely issues are or the timing for the things that we need to be thinking about. So I think we're together on that one. So is there any more conversation about the points that Linda made?
Gail's had her hand up.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah.
It really wasn't about Linda's point. It was more whether or not I could interject an addition in the charge.
Add on
that.
Okay.
You have to have the light on.
Is it on?
Yeah.
So in the bullet two of the charge, examine opportunities for the co-location of services and explore peer and managed addiction treatment services and so forth and so on. I'm assuming that peer services don't only apply to substance abuse and addiction treatment, right, that we would incorporate that for mental health as well?
Yes.
Okay, so probably it needs to just read differently.
I think that's the way it actually is intended and what it actually means.
Okay.
That's our interpretation is it includes both mental health and addiction.
Okay.
So
there is a group called Maximizing Peer Services that has both substance use and mental health people there.
There wasn't a question about it being a problem. It's just because it says it's linked to addiction services only. I didn't want it to leave out mental health services.
Thank you, sir.
I'm gonna try this out. Please agree with me. This is we spent an entire meeting and then an hour of the last meeting on the principles. This document has been circulated. We solicited comments to finalize it. That solicitation will remain open. But I would like to have an informal blessing of this principal document without further conversation today. And that will just allow us to get onto other things and ask you, can you just really read it over? And actually, it's better to read it over after today's conversation. And I think I would love to just, if anybody has a comment, why don't we say by Wednesday, right? Send in an email, little tweaking. I think we've got all the big ideas. I'd be shocked if somebody comes upon a big eureka that we forgot. But I think that it's a really nice document and helped us a lot in getting to the report outline. So thank you for all those nods. Amen. Good. Okay, so that allows us to move on then to the next section of the report.
So the next section is the bullets under number two. The global topic is financing and payment. This is where we get to John's point, which is also, I think, there's a little bit maybe reflected in the principles. But so let me just say a word about this. So there are five bullets, I guess, here under financing and payment. So what this tries to do is take those high-level issues that have already emerged from the conversation and just to try to be explicit about them. So the first one, the concept, is what we already talked about, and we were in agreement with that. The second bullet is reinvestment. And so here's the way that we tried to frame that I think is responsive to reality as well as concepts made in earlier meetings. So there are some currently identified savings targets that have already been assigned to us. So the notion is any savings beyond that from the new behavioral health management arrangement should be reinvested in behavioral health services with a high priority on housing and other high-value non-clinical support services. So that's not it's not an explicit limit there, but it's sort of a priority on the stuff that we don't have enough of that Medicaid may not pay well for. And then there are two opportunities for reinvestment or two potential candidates for savings. One is to be savings to be achieved within Medicaid behavioral health spending, and the second is medical savings that might be attributable to behavioral health improvements. Now, there's a question to be made about how that would have to be determined, and we're not going to work that out here. So this is going to have to be subject to, getting the individual's addiction under control help with respect to their emergency room visits for medical problems, as a for example. So we're trying to just articulate a principle there. So John, does this sort of capture what you had said before about this?
It does on some level, but there's a significant problem though, and that is when we say after currently identified savings targets. And again, I think that's where the tension is. So to some extent, what we're saying is, after we cut ourselves, and then, so we have, I think part of what's going to wind up coming at us, like the children's group and others, is say, okay, we have waiting lists, and we have a remarkably inadequate and broken system. So what we're going to do is we're going to take some resources from it for a little while, and then we're going to try to create savings elsewhere, and then we're going to sort of reinvest them. So I guess my initial concern is this currently identified savings target. I go to Linda's point about being forceful here. I think we should push back and say no. We're not meeting. You know, we will help you realize your overall budget part. So that's a first one. And I think, you know, the other piece is the. I think it's great to talk about the high priority reinvestment areas, but I think what we don't want to do is lose. If there are places in our system right now where there's waiting lists or inadequate levels of service, we want to make sure that those can be enriched as well. So I wouldn't want us to preclude strengthening the existing system in some ways while at the same time we're highlighting these priorities for housing and other high-value areas.
I wonder, I don't know, I know that folks at the Department of Health and others are incredibly busy at work at a number of things. That being said, I wonder if we could actually draw on some staff resources to create some estimates. We know that the repeat hospitalizations among individuals who have been hospitalized, have behavioral health issues, and are discharged is a target of savings. And we know that we can build a better system that can prevent those. And without that building, you're not going to achieve the savings. So I wonder if we could ask for a ballparking or just ask for some underlying data and ballpark for ourselves what the savings are and say, hey, listen, you know, here's the savings you can achieve. To get that savings, you need to invest in these components. And it allows us to do both things. It allows us to not shut down and fail to reflect or show that we are cognizant of the bigger picture, but also make a compelling case for the reinvestment. And to do that, and this is something you guys will know better, much better than I, is whether or not there's actually data from other places that have, starts of lessons from these type of alternatives that can give you some good, sound information that the state budget folks would safely rely on to say, okay, that's a reasonable estimate, that if we get that, then that level of rehospitalization might happen.
You know, my concern is how they're going to rebase after the savings also, because I think the new baseline, I think, is important so we'll know what the total amount of savings are and then what the rebasing is going to look like. Can I just react a little bit from a kid's perspective, even though we're going to talk about kids later, we're sort of ahead of ourselves and behind ourselves at the same time. I think that talking about a high priority for housing and other non-clinical support services is great for adults, but for kids, that's not the issue. I think the access to clinical treatment services of various sorts and some family supports is a bigger issue. And then the other places for savings where reinvestment can be considered would be around...
Access to clinical services means that the children's system is underfunded in terms of behavioral health services. Is that what you mean? Access to?
Yeah, I wouldn't really talk about it as money thing only, but I think that there just isn't enough treatment. I mean, I think the waiting list for clinic treatment, I think the access to appropriate evidence-based treatments is just really limited. Kids get backed up in the hospital because there's no place for them to go. Families need support. We're going to give a long list later in our recommendations for kids, but just as a general point, it's not going to be housing because, I mean, we're not going to discharge a little kid to their own apartment, although maybe some would put in. And then under potential savings, there really should be savings from length of stay reduction for kids and the reduction in residential beds. And I'm assuming that if we do that, we're going to find out that the cut targets are much higher for this year, for this current period, and that the base is much lower going forward. So it really matters that we try to get an estimate on what those savings are.
In what setting are you talking about?
Well, the BHO-1 is going to look at inpatients, psychiatric inpatient days, but there are other length of stay issues in juvenile justice and child welfare at the high end that have implications around behavioral health. And then the bed reductions overall, because everybody's going to try to close their beds. But in advance of actually having any capacity to receive the young people into the community and support them there.
So and then they may be more difficult to capture, but we should make mention of savings from systems outside the health services.
I think the different people at DOB have those budgets, and they're not thinking about those savings as potentially with Medicaid implications or with anything other than just reducing their budgets to meet the state PEG targets or whatever you call them.
You know, in a way, the microcosm, although now it's, thank God, a very big microcosm, is the analysis that's been done for supportive housing sort of budget justification. Folks, and there's folks at the state level that are familiar with that, drawing against savings in multiple systems to reinvest in preventive care. Okay, so that's a lot of feedback on that.
So I think the last three bullets here are just, you know, that these are sort of broad principles that come in part out of Eileen's presentation, and, you know, just the sort of the way at a very high level managed care is done, that in the future environment plans are going to be risk-bearing and capitated, that they're going to have to use various payment models. There's not one payment model that fits all sizes. There may be case rates. There may be just use a fee-for-service for some services, et cetera, et cetera. But the goals here are to assure access, efficiency, adequacy of networks, and that the plan payment should incentivize and reward positive outcomes. So that's you know, at a very high level, this is what we've got. Yeah, Ellen?
Just two things that I feel very strongly about as far as the consumer view. When you talk about reinvestment alone, you know, reinvestment has been tried before. And it hasn't had the results that it had promised. So I would want to make sure this committee is very forceful on its statements about that reinvestment, because the reality is I think that the hospital usages went sky high because that reinvestment was not there to begin with when hospitals started to
close. Right. State hospitals are free to everybody who uses them. So, you know, should it surprise you that, you know, for anybody you can get in, it's free. So, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise that there was too much of it at some point.
Well, you know, but the question, the point is that we don't want this
right to
fail. The other piece is that the issue of putting a high value on non-clinical support services, that we make these, you know, there's got to be some teeth behind it. Those are the two things that I just wanted to add.
Say more about what you mean by that.
Like peer support services in the community. You know, other services that can help people navigate both the physical health, the mental health, and the addictions piece.
Just a question on the final point there, which I think is a really strong point and a good one, talking about incentivizing patient outcomes. A little bit concerned about efficient and effective care. I mean, effective care, good, but the efficient thing, I had a question. Is there some statement we want to make about how much a plan can kind of walk away with? So I like the idea.
It's
already federal law and state law about how much plans have to spend otherwise on care, otherwise they have to give it back. So it's already baked into everything.
What is that standard?
I mean, well, depending on which, I forget whether it's large group or small group, but it's either 82% or 85%. It's part of PPACA, it's part of the state process. It's a plan that, I'm just talking commercial now, but it's the same model, a plan that only spends 70%, let's say, on the dollar, has to give that as back to as a dividend in commercial managed care. Similarly, in Medicaid, plans are held to those standards.
And usually, in at least in carved-out behavioral health plans, it's been more like, you know, 90%.
And in fact, even now, in the governor's budget this year, plans are only, they called it profit. It's really reserves. Plans are only allowed to keep 1%. It used to be 3%. and that money that plans need to keep, reserves by law, by statute. So all of those kinds of things that you think about when you talk about managed care globally, in many, many ways, through regulation, budget, and law at the state and federal level, have been chipped away at.
So I guess my point would be that we have something built into the structure of how we finance this, that there's an incentive to render the service.
Yeah, so if you go to the next page,
okay,
you'll see we've tried to address this. Okay, so I'm flipping over to page two. So we're in now to contracting.
See how he skillfully moved you along on the agenda there? Yeah.
Contracting. Geez,
Now I blew it.
Sorry.
No, we'll come back. Let Mike finish his point.
Okay, because it is on the first
page.
Okay.
All right, but just so the place where it is expected best practices in behavioral health managed care includes several of these points. So let me just talk a little bit about these things. Eileen spoke to some of these in her presentation. I spoke to some of these in mine, and we're identifying them at a level of sort of a broad principle and parameter, not precise detail. So the first principle, appropriate risk sharing between the payer and the plan. And I think I say appropriate there because there are a lot of different ways to do this. So, one of the ways that this is done is that, for example, in some contract, a lot of contracts, there are sort of bands where the plan has to control medical spending within this much and this much. And if there's too little of it, then there are penalties. And if there's more of it above this level, the plan is responsible, even though the plan may not get paid for it. But there's also a recognition that since things can go kerflooey, and ultimately, let's say the state is the deep pocket, there sometimes is a corridor between here and here where the plan is 100% liable, and then on top of that, there might be 50-50 liability, and then on top of that, the payer is 100% liable. So the point is just that there are mechanisms available to do that, and appropriate risk sharing should be appropriate. The second point here gets to the point that you were making, John, and that is that built into this to a behavioral health approach, and it's just as Eileen said, it's now a part of the national landscape. But we also know that before that, built into the behavioral health approach was essentially to set a floor on spending or medical loss ratio, and sometimes for key services within that. So one principle that's sometimes been used is that it's sort of in general, less inpatient is good, except if you reduce it so you don't have it available, then it's really bad. So, sometimes there's a desire to reduce inpatient a little bit, but to set a floor on inpatient, so it doesn't get, driven down to a level where people don't have access. So you're trying to increase access and efficiency, but you're not trying to reduce it below a certain level. So we have those two points. Performance incentives are critical, must be more robust for behavioral health performance than those incentives that are currently used. So a way to put a different way to say this is the performance incentives in behavioral health for the arenas that we're talking about, for addiction and mental health services, let's say for SSI-eligible people, those plans, those requirements are going to go beyond those requirements that currently exist for behavioral health in plans. It's more disabled population. It isn't worded very elegantly, but that's what this is supposed to get at. I don't want to read the rest for you, but let's just open this up for conversation on the top half of the second page. Under these general contracting and financial parameters. Yeah, Phil?
I have a question. Hello?
Hello? My question is about the performance incentives. It says that they're critical and must be robust. And so to whom are those incentives directed and how?
Yeah, so that has not been asked or answered yet. So what I read here is that both the plan is accountable to the payer, and plans may incentivize providers for outcomes. So we haven't yet said which, but both should theoretically be available here.
So you're saying may and not must.
I think that we've left it open. But, you know, yes, may and not must, because I don't know, I don't know if we want to incentivize too much, because then you get away from meat and potatoes just paying for care.
No, I guess I was just trying to determine. You see, performance incentives are critical. I think we can all agree on that, but we also want to agree on who receives the performance incentives.
So,
I mean,
it
may be risk sharing and incentive sharing, but it needs to become all the way down to the provider as well as to the plan.
So you're sort of proposing performance incentives are critical for plans and providers?
Yes.
As a general principle?
Yes.
Yeah, Richard?
Yeah, I think that can work, and I think it can be for both. It depends on what you're incentivizing, and I think to the extent that providers are key to delivering on those expectations, there can be sharing downstream, and I think that works. The other thing I was going to say in terms of risk sharing that Mike mentioned, I think it's also an evolving situation, so that risk sharing arrangements can evolve over time as the system matures.
Thanks, a really good point. That's one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to not get too deep into this, because we can, you know, we can think of stuff that we're not ready to handle yet.
Just a thought that I remember talking about this the first day we met. You know, we're talking about incentivizing the plan, incentivizing the provider. Where is the incentive to recover for the consumer? You know, as a system, we've created that dependency on the system. So now we're saying, okay, we're going to give you less and less and less without anything, you know, that can come back to them. So why should they get better? Why should they, you know, why should this be such a big deal? You know, where if you look to, you know, incentivize, even when people do get better, they get hurt by it. So they lose their benefit, they lose this, they lose that. Once they're off, they can't get back on. Even if they have housing, it's substandard housing.
You know, Ellen, is there any evidence-based models for consumer-driven incentives?
Mm-hmm.
So do we have some documentation on that?
Self-directed care, you know, I think I can get some together.
I think the more that we had of very concrete examples, again, if we can translate a practice into a number, into a savings, then I think
we could get some
PowerPoints after the first meeting with some evidence of self-directed care outcomes.
Okay, so we'll look at that. Good.
And I would say that, you know, self-directed care is a good thing. It's pretty complicated in mental health. There isn't a lot of success. And it sort of, this moves care money around. It gives people, you know, let's say theoretically a credit card or, you know, increased leverage on using services. So it's changing the leverage for services dollars. It doesn't necessarily get to an incentive for recovery.
I will say, I'll go over to
a separate, you know, so we, a couple of us were, actually John and Alan and I were down at Social Security on Thursday with a conversation with them about trying to advance some things with respect to employment services. So we've gone a long way in the last 2 years to provide training around benefits to, and, you know, both of you know this well because the people work in your organizations. Largely to people in recovery who can then counsel others on things like you can actually go to work and not lose your benefits. You can go to work and keep your Medicaid. You know, you can go to work and increase your income and keep your benefits. And this is what you have to do, and we can help you do all those things. So it's a separate, and I think the incentives to get a life, as Charlie Kerr used to say, home, a job, and a date on the weekends are not incentives by and large that the system can provide, but we should be facilitating as we can elsewise. And I sort of think at some level, you know, that there should be some kind of incentive to plans, I'm not sure if we've got this figured out yet, to encourage, they can't control it, but to encourage gainful employment. Because people that are working use less health care, and our people are 85% unemployed. So, we can't be paying for an employment service because Medicaid won't pay for it. So, anyway, that was all the digression. But we're over there working on incentives in that zip code, and we'd like to marry that with this.
It's a good digression, sport. Mike, and as you know, the research is that people that are getting out of poverty and are employed use less Medicaid. Maximus is a lot of that. But one way to look at this is just maybe a light thing is to spell out what we mean in the bullet above about other social supports, and I was going to put in peer support, benefits advisement, employment, family support, things like that, that may make it clearer what we think is going to help
but people get well.
Okay.
Mike, just on the floor idea, not so much the funding, but the key services, I'm wondering a little bit, you know, rooted in the principles part of our document, you know, would we be making a recommendation about what that floor is, you know, relative to some continuum of services? It would seem to me that we would want to clearly state that failure to provide a floor of X would result in the kind of emergency room visits and the kind of unnecessary hospitalizations that we're trying to prevent. So I'm just wondering whether we'll make a specific any specific recommendations about what the service floor should be or not.
It seems to me that can only be done in looking at data, first of all, and then in the context of a contract negotiation. So usually the way this is done, for example, I mean, experience that I had in another place where Ohio went for its state employees, took its behavioral health program from a very generous indemnity program to managed care. And so the logic in that approach was to sort of look at the historical spend rate that had been in the indemnity arena and then to try to, you know, set a goal. How much do we want outpatient increased? How much do we want outpatient penetration increased? How much do we think inpatient should go down? What do we think is the floor below which inpatient should not fall? Those kind of things. So, but it's pretty hard to do that without looking at the actual data. And so I think that to some extent is a contract. It's not a principle. It's a part of contract negotiation.
But is there not like some continuum that we would want to, like relative to like creating the, you know, not necessarily an articulation of a menu of dependent services, but some articulation of what minimally a resident in New York should expect if they've got a child with a mental health problem or somebody in their family with a substance use disorder?
I don't know what you have in mind. Phil?
Well, doesn't, in the Pennsylvania plan, isn't there actually a state regulation requiring that 90 cents on the dollar be paid for service overall? Now, that doesn't get to the subcategories.
I'm not sure that there is, but I think that's where we're going, although I think it's a little premature to say what the actual number is.
Me, in New York State, I think in Pennsylvania it is 90 cents. It is 90 cents.
That number has been used in a number of, you know, contracts. But I'm not sure that's the state of the art. I'm not sure where we're going to be when we end up. I'm not sure how much we're going to load onto plan requirements or reserve requirements in ways that would increase their costs. So, I think we're saying in principle where we want to go. I'd just be a little loath to get, you know, too deeply into the weeds. So I'm trying to think, John, to come back to your point. Now, if you look at the next bullet, we've said some things at a very broad level. That just, again, this is at a broad level, so that the emphasis, this is what I've heard emerging from the conversation so far, we would like to see expanded access to office-based ambulatory services. This, the editorial comment that UM is usually not applied to those services because it's not worth it. That we think there are some possibilities for reduced use of inpatient care, but they have to be consistent with assured timely and appropriate access whenever it is clinically necessary. As Ron Diamond, a community psychiatrist, says, the fewer beds you have, the more important it is to have one available when you need it. So it's, and then a third bullet here is, and this is something that takes place over time, appropriate development and substitution of less costly and more appropriate alternatives to inpatient care. But you can't move too rapidly on that. So the basics of this world are to keep the ambulatory stuff in place, make sure that you have access to inpatient, and then work over time to try to achieve a better mix. So that's about what we're saying here. Beyond that, I'm not sure how much, you know, for example, there is a Medicaid benefit in New York for mental health and addiction services. So I think, you know, unless something has changed in the relationship with the feds, that benefit has to be available to people as is individually needed, as is medically necessary, and has to be available without geographic distinction. So
I wonder if a way to handle this without, because
because our time is short, I wonder if a way to handle this is to state these very broad parameters and then to give examples of other things that exist elsewhere. For instance, in a place this is defined. For instance, here are three examples of a more robust coordinated system that are very promising models and we think should be pursued. And so we don't have to end at a broad statement, but we don't have to also go through and act like in the next several weeks we can come up with the exact right thing, but instead say here are the models of the type that need investment to achieve the savings. That might be a nice way to tip our hand a lot stronger on what we need.
I'm going to say something you've heard before, Mike, and I have a new audience, so I'd like this group really to consider going forward with a recommendation since we are going to have probably likely some compression in the inpatient capacity given some of the stress in the hospital sector right now. Some consideration to the threshold rate reductions in the clinic. I think it's a little counterintuitive if we want to be focusing our efforts in care in the community and lower cost settings, having access in a timely manner. That might be something that we could bring forward. And the other comment is...
You're ahead of me technically, so I don't understand what you're recommending.
The 30%, 50% cut in clinic,
okay.
The 45-visit cut in...
Oh, the utilization
yeah,
control stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
okay.
I'm not
right.
saying it.
Right.
And the other thing is, to move the integration issue forward, I think the 5% cap in the OA agency settings is a little artificial, and if we really want to integrate some health care into these OA agency settings, that is way too low, practically.
Okay, now I understand. I think that's helpful because I think both of these things will go away when we move into a waivered managed care environment. Pardon? I just think they will. I mean, people, it's going to have to be done more sensitively. Paul?
Several additional criteria that I think based on the experience that we've had seeing what's happening around the country would be important to add for the expected best practices. I don't know if this is a good time to do that in addition to the ones that are here. So I'll tick them off very quickly. One is appropriate and preferably standardized screening across the behavioral health system. And I know that that's something also we would talk about in other systems with ESPERT and all, but that within the behavioral health system also. Also appropriate and preferably standardized criteria for determining what people need, what level of care, what length of stay. And that may go to some extent also to the issue that John and others raised about what services do people need, making sure that people get screened and then an appropriate criteria then that people get what they need. A third one is adding in the category there of special emphasis, also access to appropriate medications when they are appropriate, since we've seen that as a particular problem. Another one would be the requirements of the federal parity-like legislation, including both on the transparency of criteria. The criteria must be public and that reasons for denials must be given. And also the requirement in the federal parity law that no qualitative limitations as well as quantitative are allowed that are different from medical surgical. And then a last one would be honoring, it's kind of related to the screening and criteria, I should have mentioned it there, which would be to honor diagnoses that come from other places, including criminal justice or juvenile justice or other systems where an appropriate screening or diagnosis is done.
So in a way, we have mirror components in this outline. That's, I can't count both, 2, 4, 5. It's the 6th bullet down under, it's the 6th sub-bullet under the 2nd bullet, and which is not all of what you just said on medical care and behavioral health clinics, and then it has its companion under item 4. And so I think what you just did is you just sort of expanded a great deal on those on those two components about sort of the client interaction best practice tools.
Right, and also because it wasn't clear to me, and maybe it's just the shorthand, that when it says medical care, is that referring to the behavioral health care as well as
the physical care?
It's
meant to be the physical.
Right, I thought maybe, and that's why I was saying that there also needs to be all of these things focusing on the behavioral health as well, that,
uh-huh.
the criteria.
So that's number four. That's there. But I think those are all good points.
Good.
So we've blown our time here, so we're going to move very quickly now.
Before you move, it's just a comment. The very first bullet, I would feel much more comfortable if you say OMH, OASIS,
yes.
in consultation
yes.
with.
That's a good question.
My oversight
for that.
Donna?
Yes, question.
On the 1115 waiver, some of the recommendations that I think might be under that, that are systems barrier recommendations to even in terms of some of the regulatory silos that we're in, as an example, like TCM morphing to health phones is a good thing because you break down some of the, you know, four visit stuff. But that's true in a couple of silos. Will we be talking about that at some other point? Some suggestions or recommendations related to breakdown of some system issues. I mean, one was mentioned around the 5% medical, but there are some other, I think, ideas that could potentially, I think, benefit what we're all trying to achieve here, and they happen to be around regulatory. ACT is a great example, and I don't know if we're going to have that conversation at some point. So I'll hold off on my recommendations, but I hope we will have that.
Well, there's a good question about, you know, sort of where we can get really deeply into the weeds, you know, in next door, in another town, you know, there's some of those things that are also pretty important. I'm not sure the best way to address those. I think one of the things that are we going to have the time to sit around and talk all those things through here? You know, probably not. Do we want to get those things out? And, you know, I think we're doing a pretty good job of beginning to get at that. But I think what we probably ought to do is to say that to the extent we can identify issues like that that need attention, that they probably should be submitted to the co-chairs. So I think what I want to do, because we've blown the time, is we've done a good job. We've gone through three quarters of this, and most of the rest that we have is stuff that we haven't got to yet. So I think that's okay. So let's leave this with your comments as an improved. We'll have an improved working draft the next time around. And to the extent anybody has questions or suggestions, like those that you're thinking about, like the one Paul just made that we haven't got to yet, please. Send them to Linda and I so we can take them into consideration for a next iteration of this working draft. But I think this is we've gone over a little bit, but it's been a very good conversation. And I know that since Gail has gotten started so quickly and so efficiently, we can probably even make up time with respect to how the children's group is doing. So,
thank you. Do you want to dispense with the discussion around health homes and kids first?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the issues, let me just say that we've had one meeting, and we've got about four or five meetings scheduled. There are 15 members of our solution-focused team. What you have in front of you is the operating framework and core beliefs that we developed that will be companions to the principles. We're trying to organize our work consistent with the framework for the BHO work group overall so that everything blends, and so we're going to have to do a little bit of realignment because we made it up because our meeting came before the framework of the larger BHO. But that will be very easy. Our charge was to involve experts, families, and youth with knowledge and experience specific to children with SED and substance use disorders in the specification of a children's chapter within the BHO subcommittee report. As I said, there are about 15 members and many ex officio members and staff of the state agencies. We've got representation from all of the children's service systems at the state level, which is extremely helpful, and so that will make it possible for us to round out our recommendations and deal with the interagency issues. Our goal is to communicate a vision for advancing children's behavioral health through Medicaid managed care, et cetera, and so forth. We're going to identify specific recommendations that are achievable. We are going to make
around mainstream Medicaid managed care and on the BHO, what we're calling phase two design, and then, as I said, try to make sure that everything aligns with the larger BHO work. What you have in front of you is our third draft. It's being worked on again as we sit here through the magic of technology. I would encourage you all to take a look at it and just send your comments to me or Kristen Riley at OMH, and we will make sure to integrate all of them. But because we have not aligned them with the larger group principles, you know, don't think this is the last word. We do want to finish this visions and values statement up on Wednesday if we can. So our time frame is very short. To make our work a little bit easier, we requested that we take the conversation around health homes for kids off the table for now and put that into a separate bucket to be dealt with later in the fall. And so through the great advocacy of Kristen Riley and Commissioner Hogan, that miracle was achieved, and we're going to talk about kids' health homes after Labor Day.
So this is specific for kids with severe emotional disturbance. So this is not, you know, not to say the kids with medical illnesses couldn't be in a health home. But.
And that's pretty much it. I'm happy to take any questions or comments if you have any. Many of you are sitting around these tables twice a week now, so I just want to say thank you to everybody.
Congratulations on that victory. So, yeah, Wendy?
Yes, we have representatives from the education system, juvenile justice, child welfare, I'm skipping some, mental health, addiction and substance abuse. I think we sort of have everybody at the table. And the goal is really to try to figure out how to look at the integration across all those systems, because the implications for kids' movement and reducing length of stay in psychiatric inpatient, preventing hospitalization, helping young people achieve their potential, reduce symptoms, function normally in the community, in family, in school, depends on all these other systems doing their job.
Ms. Clark, thank you.
That was really quick, too, so.
I might not have given appropriate props to everybody around the table, kids, people, so I just want to say thank you again.
Can I correct this for a second? She's done an absolutely superb job. We had a meeting the other day that was just absolutely packed in. Remarkably well run, well prepared. It was really good. It was very, very good. You know, one of the things with health, and I was somewhat reminded when Linda was speaking earlier about the forceful approach, you know, we were very cognizant of the entire conversation about the kids. And I remember stories we told our very first meeting. We had a tendency to digress a little bit into the lingo and the finance discussion, which is fundamentally about a lot of people that are, you know, experiencing very difficult problems and we're trying to help the system and help them. And one thing Gail started out by saying was this might be one of, for some of us, it'll be our last chance to get this right. And so, you know, there's a real burden of responsibility.
I did that.
That's a good thing.
Thank you for saying that.
Excellent. So we'll move to the presentation on behavioral health management and substance use services. Arlene, do you want to frame that at all, or Rob, you're going to? Yeah. I think we have these on slides somewhere.
No, we're going to go through all 31 word by word. Just kidding. It's more important for you to have the presentation to look at as we move forward. We'll sort of hit some of the high points. Commissioner, do you want me to sit over there to do it?
I can just move them.
Okay.
You know, transitions. I can just advance if you will.
Okay.
And why don't you actually sit here? Let's pull up the chair so everybody can see where we're going.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. All right. As I said, we're not going to do all 30 pages. We had presented at the first meeting sort of an OASIS 101 as it relates to the Medicaid system, and we thought that we'd do sort of a version 2 that takes it a little bit beyond that, speaks to some of the experience for OASIS and its providers with managed care, with Medicaid itself, and what's going on in other states. So with that, sort of as an overview, the first four slides really speak to when OASIS supports the SAMHSA vision of a good and modern system, particularly the emphasis on supports that go beyond traditional clinic-based services. And I think a lot of that conversation has been going on. If you move to slide 5, I'm sorry, because I'm going to rip through it pretty quickly. One of the observations, one of the points we want to make is that our experience and our research shows that most of the large states that are managing the Medicaid population for behavioral health benefits are doing so through a specialized behavioral health entity, which is similar, although it's starting to change a little bit on the commercial side. A lot of plans seem to be bringing the management of the behavioral health. It's about 50-50 now, I think, what we're hearing. Eileen's shaking her head, but by and large, the history has been that on behavioral health benefits, the management, whether it's commercial or in the Medicaid world, has been dedicated to an entity that manages the behavioral health benefits specifically. Moving forward to slides 8 and 9, what's carved in and what's carved out of New York State Medicaid managed care for substance use disorder. We talked a little bit about this at the first meeting, and there is effort ongoing and other MRT proposals to deal with what's carved in and carved out. I think behavioral health sort of sets aside because of the BHO phase 1 and what we're doing here, but again, just to reiterate, SUD services in New York, they're a blend of carved in and carved out services and individuals. Inpatient detox, inpatient rehabilitation are generally carved in. However, the populations that most frequently access those benefits because of some status are not carved in, and their services are paid for on a fee-for-service. So you would notice on the BHO RFP phase 1, that's primarily where OASIS is focused. Because most of the inpatient detox, inpatient rehab services, and a significant amount of the Medicaid spending is still in a fee-for-service arena. So if you move forward to slides 10 and 11, really relevant points. New York State insurance law, and this is not Medicaid, it's more, but it'll have an impact on Medicaid. There are provisions in the state insurance law for large group commercial insurers, so 50 employees or more. There's a mandate for up to 60 visits, outpatient visits for any plan, and there's what's called make available or riders, as other folks call them, for up to 30 days of inpatient and 7 days of detox. What's really important with all of those is the impact of federal parity that passed a number of years ago. And the insurance department issued circular letters, and actually the health departments also issued letters. Health department's letter spoke to the fact that Medicaid managed care is covered by federal mental health parity. The Department of Insurance's circular letter spoke more about the fact that because federal parity doesn't distinguish between the type of benefit in the substance use disorder world, it just speaks to the benefit itself. Across the board, there is no distinction. All the benefits that are now in New York State law are a mandate by impact for large group commercial insurance companies, or insurance policies, excuse me. They're the floor now. You can go higher. But in New York now, those two make availables that I talked about, 30 days of inpatient and 7 days of detox, are now mandates by virtue of the impact of the federal health parity. Slide 12 and 13, One of the things that we did in 09 and 10 was a survey of our providers in the OASIS system more about the impact in the commercial managed care world, and you know, just trying to get a sense from our providers who did interact with managed care in the commercial world, some of their experiences, and some of the concerns. The two that I would highlight for you, first being that there seemed to be a use of medical necessity criteria that was more mental health than it was substance use disorder. It spoke to the person being a danger to themselves or others. And one of the key issues, and we addressed this with the insurance department, we credential KSACs in our system. We have over 7,000 of them. They're an integral part of any of our programs. There was a lot of denial of payment and coverage for the services provided by a KSAC. To be clear, New York State Insurance Department regulations specifically say that care provided by an OASIS program, even if the care is provided by someone who isn't, and I'm paraphrasing, independently able to bill for those services, has to be covered. So we don't think that's as much of an issue as it was, but we had a very collaborative effort with Department of Health and the Insurance Department as we move that forward. Slide 13, a couple of the big things that are of import to OASIS. Calculations as we move forward on capitation rates for the Phase 2 behavioral health management clearly need to be transparent. Existing OASIS providers should, to all extent possible, be protected through relatively open panels, but more importantly, be held to meeting outcomes that are put forward that they need to meet as part of the contracting for the services. And we do think that phase one of the BHOs, if one of the things it will offer us, is an opportunity while we implement the APG system to get a better sense of service utilization patterns and the cost in the OASIS system. Slides 14 and through 22, so you can just sort of move through them, but, and thank you, by the way. Points that we'd like to make. The SUD system has some very unique population and treatment modalities, methadone being the largest, and we have over 40,000 individuals in the OASIS certified methadone treatment system. And in certain areas of our system itself has a significant number of individuals who are mandated by criminal justice. So when Paul's making points about the import and impact of those, absolutely critical to be considered. Most SUD services are accessed through publicly funded and not private office-based providers. SUD services, from our perspective, must include and don't to any significant extent right now include care coordination. And clearly we need to enforce parity through the systems of services that we establish, but also through the capitated rates that we set up or are set up as we move towards a more managed system. And Paul hit on a point, I'll reemphasize it, need to assure appropriate assessment and level of care tools are used and that such reviews are conducted by appropriately credentialed or licensed individuals. Clearly we have a preference for KSACs, but it is important for individuals who are going to make level of care determinations for substance use disorder services to have understanding and expertise with those service systems. Clearly for the OASIS world, we need to preserve the multidisciplinary team approach, which for our system includes paraprofessionals, many of whom are in recovery. It's a mix of licensed, credentialed staff and unlicensed staff, and that's an important aspect. It's part of recovery in the substance use world, and it's an important aspect of it. It needs to be preserved. Another really critical piece, which is starting to get traction within our system, but there are still issues, the need to support Medicaid-supported recovery. which is more than methadone. Vivitrol, buprenorphine, there are medical pharmacological interventions that are effective, not as widely used in our system. We think that this subcommittee and the work that we're doing, there's an opportunity to support those efforts. Need to develop performance measures that are specific to substance use disorder. HEAT is not, it lacks SUD indicators. There's some work going on in the states. We'll bring forward more information as we move this forward, but just the point that we wanted to make. Slide 23, again, I want to reemphasize, capitation and contract requirements must be clearly related to SUD and mental health and monitored by the treatment agencies, which we were happy to see that that's part of the draft outline as we're moving forward. Slides 24 through 26, I mean, looked at them. Again, I apologize I'm going forward, but I'm trying to save time for people to talk about all the other things that are on the agenda. BHOs, even in phase one, need to play a significant role in the development of health homes, including possibly being health homes, at a minimum being part of the enrolling and referring process. And that's a huge piece for the OASIS world. We're trying to expand the concept and the service of care coordination. The MATS program that we all speak about, to give you context, statewide has about 900 people enrolled in it. Targeted case management in the OMH system has, I think, over 35,000 in that range, guys. Yeah, it's over 30,000 people. So because the program is paid for by state general fund money, this is a real opportunity, health homes, to take it, but we, you know, take it and expand it, make it a system-wide service. But at the same time, we think there's an opportunity to take advantage of the phase one BHOs that we're developing and have them play an integral role. They're going to be in inpatient settings in the MH and SUD systems. We think it's a real opportunity to take advantage of that. So we'll be advocating for that. Another point, I mean, it's been raised already, savings on behavioral health and physical health. Medicaid spending should be reinvested, particularly in other recovery supports. I'm not going to repeat anymore. Everyone's been saying it. Slide 27, and I know that this is an area that's important to New York City. We agree with it, the concept, particularly starting with New York City, that you know, the concept of a special needs plan that allows that plan to manage all the care needs, physical health and behavioral health, and assume the whole risk. We've talked with the city. We agree with them. We think it's a good idea. We'd look for the group to support that as we move forward. I'll be closing very quickly here. Slides 28 and 30, again, they were presented the first meeting, but it's more to reemphasize the context. 260,000 unique individuals treated in the OASIS system in 2010. 159,000 of those, are 60%, were Medicaid recipients. So there is a smaller percentage than the MH system for Medicaid recipients in the OASIS system. Two other points, $870 million spent on Medicaid fee-for-service substance use disorder services in 2010. More than $1.75 billion was spent to provide non-SUD services to recipients of SUD services in that same period of time. So when there's a conversation about integration of services, we think there's an opportunity to not only integrate by bringing primary care in, but go to where the people are. I mean, the mental health clinics, the SUD clinics, real opportunity for individuals. They've been engaged in care. If the MH or SUD clinics properly staffed, and this goes to that 5% APG rule, we agree that it should be eliminated. They've engaged in our system, in one of our programs, allowing them to treat more than just the behavioral health need, we think, would be very wise for both the patient. patient and for the Medicaid system in terms of the funding that's being spent. And just to end it, the key recommendations that we want to make, they're not all, but they're key. It's on slide 31. ESPRT must be part of all health home patient assessments. ESPRT screening, brief intervention for referral to treatment, it's an evidence-based practice. The prevention panel that's part of designating prevention services under the Affordable Care Act has designated it as an evidence-based practice, meaning as of September 2010, it needs to be covered in commercial managed care. We absolutely think, and we take it beyond that on behalf of the mental health system, depression screening and ESPRT, we think are essential elements of any assessment that's going to be provided for someone who's going to be designated and enrolled in a health home. Again, phase one BHOs, we think, need to be active participants in health home enrollment, assignment, and service delivery. Again, they're going to be working with our inpatient system, many of those folks, especially in the OASIS world, inpatient detox, are individuals whose only care in our system is they come into a detox, they leave, they come back when they need it, they cycle in and out of detoxes. That's the population I think we're all trying to reach with health homes. You've now got a plan in place working with our provider. It's also the opportunity for them to potentially work with those patients to try to get them really engaged. Again, the APG 5% cap on physical health services we think should be eliminated. And another element that I know is important to New York City, it's important to OASIS. Even the 800 individuals we have in MATS, the concept of the program we think is consistent with health homes. We need to preserve what already exists. Most of, to put it in even further context, out of those 800, 700 of them are in New York City. But we are limited in our scope by the amount of funding we have available to expand it. Health homes is the opportunity. That being said, for those 700 individuals who are already in the system, the worst thing we could do would be to disrupt an existing relationship with a care coordinator, with the provider they're engaged with. So we think there's an opportunity to preserve because at its base, it's care coordination for individuals who've had high utilization in the substance use world. Perfect opportunity. We would, you know, we just close by saying we're happy to see that the first cut draft contains most of this and actually is consistent with where OASIS would like to see things go. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. That's terrific. Let's have a little bit of conversation, but let me also ask that if you can together work to get the key points that aren't in the outline to us so that I think most of it is in there, but there also are a number of specific things that you've raised that are more particular to substance use treatment services that we need to have included. So, do you have comments?
Yeah, an observation. Both OMH and OASIS seem to understand that not wanting to have separate relationships for people that are either in MATS or in TCM as going into care coordination as they go into care coordination roles in health homes. And just a thought about how it seems to me we have to add training sort of competencies, add competencies to these two groups to be about health and medical issues so that they can perform all these functions. And I think that's something the health department should consider, and if any Obama money should fund it.
Yeah.
Last meeting, forgetting which meeting now because I go to a lot of meetings, but I think it was this last meeting, we talked about seeing TCM and MATS as parallel practices, you know, in the generic sense. And we also talked about how it might be envisioned that targeted case management programs transition to become health homes and the incentives to pay, especially in the first year to become a target for a TCM program to become a health home quickly. Are we able to make the same set of inferences about the MATS program?
You know, I mean, we're going to treat them, consistently in terms of ultimately care coordination will be done through health homes. So, again, it's a smaller scale. The size of the MH system creates unique differences and complications that aren't necessarily there for us. But ultimately, yeah, we're going to look for health homes because there's another competing MRT proposal that actually Deputy Mayor Gibbs put forward to triple the MATS program. The opportunity, I mean, clearly if it's a state general fund-funded program, tripling it is not going to happen as it exists. Health homes gave us the vehicle, the opportunity to expand it. We're going to, work with the city we already have in terms of expanding it. But for the OASIS system, because it is targeted, just call it whatever it is, case management, targeted case management, it's a major missing piece in the OASIS system. We're going to work to transition existing MATs into health homes, but we want to go way beyond that. We want it to be a service across the system. We don't want it to be in New York City and five other counties.
Rob, the MATS program, the city, the Department of Mental Health did an excellent cost-benefit analysis that basically said for the last 3 years they've saved $10 million in each of those years. That's with a voluntary participation. And so I think, to Linda's earlier query about demonstrating specific savings, if we know that the criteria for participating in the program was $25,000 or more of addiction-specific Medicaid expenditures, and that's an arbitrary line, you could have said 20,000 or 15, and we could draw the line any place. So the 3,500 people or the 33,000 people that we had that fit that criteria, we're only working with 750 of them. Had recommended, I think as well, tripling the caseload, and then we went to DOB afterwards and said, actually, you could do more than that if you want to. The larger that program gets, the more amplified the savings will be because some of the folks who aren't volunteering are folks that are really sort of on the periphery of the service delivery system. So the more we're able to manage all of those, and that's, I think, low-hanging fruit for us in terms of talking about the potential savings that could be realized when we implement this behavioral health system that we're going to be advocating for. So I think that's just one example of low-hanging fruit to demonstrate with some good empirical evidence behind it.
Yeah, and I think, as we move forward with health homes, the state's likely going to seek a waiver to make auto-assignment. I mean, clearly you also have to place protections in place for individuals who don't want to be in it, but I think you'll see more individuals placed into care coordination. It's also the opportunity to get, you pointed out, and actually I think it went down to 15,000.
Is it 15?
20? It's 20, but we're not stuck with that rule in health homes. We created that. We can uncreate it. Yeah, Donna.
I know we're going to be talking about health homes, but one of the potential ideas is that health homes be robust and include service providers, obviously, that are in substance use world and the mental health world, obviously health, and that what I like about your presentation also acknowledges that there are specialties within those, in that context, specialties within substance use and specialties in mental health, and depending upon, kind of what quadrant somebody sits in terms of what their primary is, a good health home would sort of acknowledge that and understand that the care coordination should have a certain expertise attached to a particular individual as a primary problem. But I kind of see health homes as sort of the overall rubric for a much more integrated network, which would include substance use as well as behavioral health as well as health.
Yeah, and I think Greg made the point when he presented at the last meeting. They're hoping to get as broad an array of health homes. I think the application went up today to start the process on the DOH website. So I think we would agree. We do think some part of it needs to have a real expertise or a centricity on substance use disorder treatment in order
because there is a segment. We looked at his numbers. You looked at his numbers. Where that really is the driving issue in their world. And if we intervene there, it's the opportunity, as you know, to intervene with other things that are going on with those individuals.
Rob, it was distressing, though, that, you know, and Paul mentioned this in his comments and you did in your presentation, that screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment, and screening for depression are not a required dimension of the health homes as they've originally been constituted. So while it's talked about, and again, it's talked about broadly in the medical, I don't know about broadly, but it's talked about in the medical community already. So I think a strong recommendation from this group might go far in encouraging the health department to incorporate such a requirement, you know, when it comes to the implementation phase. Just because it's not in our federal proposal doesn't mean it won't be required. So we should really push hard, I think, to make sure that that's part of all of our health homes.
Yeah, well, remember right now that there's a draft state plan amendment in front of CMS from New York State, and it's for phase one. You know, the state Department of Health views there being multiple phases of health home, but part of the process and part of this group's charge is to make recommendations. So.
Lori? Does there need to be a reference to the MAPS program as well in the DOH SPA?
In the DOH SPA,
the draft.
I think what I would say is similar to the outline which said OMH and really everyone's view was that it also was OASIS. That's part of what's going on with DOH. We've pointed out, and they're making clarifications. Again, it's a draft SPA.
Okay.
And they're taking comments.
I think just in terms of the documents we were talking about before where we have best practices, maybe we should incorporate the substance use services into those best practices in a clearer way, just so it's very obvious how important it is, including
yes.
the medication part, because I
yes.
think
yes.
on the behavioral health side, there's not a lot of experience with that.
Yeah, so we sort of made that deal. Arlene and staff will add key stuff to the outline.
But the outline contains, I mean, there's a few specific things that we can add, which Commissioner had already asked we do. So
I think this is a very helpful presentation. I think it brings to the attention of the group many of the things that are particular, but I learned more that it's a very common in approach. The challenges are the same and a lot of common themes, and so reiterating those on the substance abuse side and then bringing in the recommendations that are specific to substance abuse, I think we can work right off of this and integrate those in. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, so right on time. Thanks, Rob. So as I think Lori said, the health home application supposedly is go live today, but it's not up yet. That's probably why Greg's not here, because you know they. But you know, so if not today, very soon. We understand that the submission date is going to be a month from today, and what Greg said at the last meeting was that the goal was to have everything up and running and people being enrolled October 1. So we noticed that was going to be done before our report was done. So we thought maybe we ought to spend a little bit of time identifying key issues that would need to be or should need to be addressed. And some of these might be recommendations to DOH. Others might be recommendations that the co-chairs with Commissioner Sanchez might take to DOH. Some of these might be recommendations for the state agencies to, you know, as this thing plays out. So we wanted to spend a little bit of time on developing initial recommendations that we could brainstorm here today and prioritize. And then that we could advance them without waiting for the final report, just sort of, you know, to anyway, so that's the notion. So I think this is sort of my proposal about how to do this is sort of a modified sticky dots. So I think what we'll do is we'll go around the table and nominate. So I think what we're in the zone of is recommendations for mental health and addiction services and the implementation of health homes. So we'll just go around and do recommendations. What I think I'd like to recommend is that as you write the recommendations down, when you go to recommendation two, leave a little bit of space in case anybody wants to make one that amplifies a recommendation that's already up there and number them. So we're just going to go around and once or twice and get a list, and then we'll just do a straw poll. Talk about it if we need to, and try to identify the ones that have the most urgency for the group, and then we'll figure out how to advance those to the powers that be, whoever they are. So let's just sort of open this up, and we'll scribe. Does anybody know how to get the screen up? Well, we don't necessarily have to do it. We could. So we're going to have a couple pages of lists. I'm just thinking about how we post them. Cool. A man of many talents. Michael knows how to turn this thing off. You unplug it as a last resort. So we'll brainstorm. We'll put the stuff up here. We'll do a straw poll, and we'll see if we can come up with ideas. So let's just sort of open this up. Let's try to get things out in about 10 minutes or something like that and spend some time discussing it. So
can I just take the prerogative? Because I think this is, and you guys tell me, our reaction is that the health home concept has a lot of attributes that are exactly what we're looking for in terms of care management. And so our concern, which I think is great, all comes in the form of yes, but, that we endorse the principle, the approach, we feel strongly it's right, but we've got a lot of special needs. Is that right? So is that where we are?
Yes, and you
listen to the training better than I do. But I'm educable. So that would be my starting point. I'm glad to see the nod.
Yes.
Okay.
So Lori has the floor.
I want to say something about the targeted case management and mass money. And, here's the cognitive behavioral statement. Health homes are great, and money that is derived from case management and mass funds should follow the client. And, if health homes are no longer in 2 years, the same amount of money should be available for case management and mass services to indicated clients as when the money went in. Sorry.
So you're basically saying level fund case management?
No, I'm saying to preserve the funding, even within health homes, for mass and for TCM when they become part of the health home funding structure, that money should follow the clients that it serves currently, or at least the behavioral health clients that it is intended to serve, and that, that money should be in perpetuity available to behavioral health clients.
So the money goes in with the clients, and when the 2 years of enhanced match is over, the money should still be available. Okay? Good. Phil?
I think Lori said it, but I just wanted to emphasize that it stays with the behavioral health system. In other words, it's not used for care coordination for high-needs consumers for other disorders.
Well, let me just enter into that. So we'll talk about this just to clarify as we go on. So when Lori's recommendation was when moved into the health homes and after, and after 2 years.
Forever.
So that's the second point.
Yes.
Now, so these are behavioral health funds, whether it's TCM, or whether it's or whether it's MATS. However, one of the ands that we've thought of is if a mental health case manager can also get additional skills in healthcare coordination for the people they're taking care of, it's great as far as we're concerned if they perform that function. We're going to have to think what that means in terms of caseloads and all that stuff. But we tend to be of the mode of lighten up on the caseloads, get the work done, take care of the whole person.
Okay.
So is that consistent, Phil, with your...
I think it's consistent. I just want to be sure that the funds are not diverted so that when the 90-10 goes away, that it's replaced with 50-50 funds.
We got that.
Used to coordinate the high-needs, high-use behavioral health clients for all their needs. Yes.
Yes. So that's understood as part of what Lori said. Yeah. Harvey?
A couple things. On the
issue of cultural, because it's critical to serve particularly underserved groups like people of color, that health homes really need to have special care and incentives to do outreach and engagement and have the kind of workforce that's effective in those communities.
So we are supposed to have, and this is a confession, I haven't actually read all the stuff posted about this, but even though I haven't read it, I've read somewhere that a part of the DOH plan for health homes is that 80% of the full amount will be paid before people are engaged for a period that's limited to 3 months to get them engaged.
Right.
Bob, is that right? Okay. So this is an incentive. That's an incentive for outreach, right? Okay. So you're adding to that the notion of a diverse.
There should be some special attention to make sure that once again communities of color are not the ones that don't get effective outreach and penetration. The other thing I would just add too is just the usual mantra about health homes have to have some connection to essential community supports like housing, peer support, employment. In order to be effective, the success of health homes is going to be dependent on their coordination with the essential community supports like housing, peer support, employment.
So, Harvey, let me push back. So that's like a good chicken in a pot, in every pot kind of statement. But what operationally are you suggesting? I want to just sharpen that a little bit. It's a, you know, it's a nice principle,
right?
But the application is being posted today. So what really operationally?
We actually said this last week on the webinar on the health. We said that the outcomes. They were asking us to identify what should be the measures for health home success, and we said beyond the usual HEDIS ones like 7 days to the clinic and taking your medicine, it would be, you know, having connection to these other domains. So they should be judged by that because it's essential to their success. I don't know what more to say about it.
So Donna's got one. That's good. Then Paul, Eileen.
I think the issue of auto assignment, because I think what's going to start happening is auto assignment. So I think we have to really pay attention to that. So And a consumer choice in terms of if a health home network doesn't have a provider that they're interested in, I think, because they're going to be assigned to a health home. We're not quite sure what the algorithm is going to be yet in terms of auto assignment, and there's been, so I think we need to influence that, because for many individuals, let's say I live in a shelter, I may get auto assigned based on the last address that I showed up in an ER. I may be nowhere near that health home. Health home is responsible within 90 days engagement to find somebody, but we may be spinning our wheels if we're not collaborating around this issue of assignment. Like DHS in the city would be a good network to figure out, well, this person's zip code, I got this person's in my health home, but they may not be anywhere near the geography of the health home that gets approved and developed.
Okay.
So, and then there's people with connectivity already.
I understand the concern.
Okay.
Is there a suggestion you would make about how to resolve that if people are going to be auto-assigned then?
Right. Well, I think that we maybe we can establish some sort of hierarchy around the algorithm, but also to allow for a process to sort of connect around the auto assignment at a different level so that we're making sure the actual assignment makes sense. So if we have data, I'm using DHS as an example, in the city, if someone's last place of residence if someone's attached to housing, that might be a place, or if someone's already in service with a provider in the network. I'm in service with a provider, but that provider's not in the health home I'm now assigned to. Like, is there a way
with the use of enrollment brokers or something?
Well, I'm trying to think, like, if the data is available, are we connecting the dots around some of this data as where people are getting services, where they live? When we're auto-assigning.
I wonder if enrollment brokers would help with that, but also the idea when there's some provision where you can opt out of, you're automatically assigned to it, but if you don't like it, you can opt out of health homes. People might need some help in...
You can,
Let's hold that point. That's another, it's another one. So you give Paul, and then Eileen, and then John.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that the two recommendations that OASIS made that were in Rob's last slide related to health homes go up on our list, one that expert in depression should be mandatory to do assessments for people at health homes, and also that the existing MATS program should be preserved and care coordination expanded throughout the SUD system via health homes.
So, and we have one more. It's a new sheet, though. Go ahead. How do you word that, Rob, or how do you want to word that, Paul?
For the second one, the way it's that the MATS program, the existing MATS program, must be preserved and care coordination must be expanded throughout the SUD system via health home.
I feel kind of weird because everybody's sort of nodding about health homes, and obviously the concepts are something we all can embrace, but I don't get it. And I'm totally and absolutely confused about this whole health home initiative, and I've talked to 3 or 4 or 5 people in the health department as well as other people. I have not sat in on those various webinars, so maybe some of you can answer the question. From the health plan perspective, if everybody we're talking about is going to be in some form of managed care, so far we're talking about some sort of specialized plan, that's kind of relatively easy, but then there's a lot of other folks who are in mainstream managed care plans and or will be, who are not in the SNP, assume there's a SNP, and so the health home idea is something that makes a lot of sense, I think, for various people, but I don't understand at all, and each time I ask somebody at the health department, I've now gotten a different answer every single time, how all that fits together, so that you take somebody and they're assigned to the XYZ health home, but they're also a member of Fidelis or Emblem or any of the plans. So now, how does the money, and when I asked the question at the last meeting, what Greg Allen said was that person would get assigned to the health home, the plan would then get money in the premium to pay the health home. But I don't understand how the accountability, the money, the quality, all of that works together so that you have somebody in a health
home. Which gets back to our principles where we talked about accountability and control, that we wanted approaches that have clear accountability for outcomes but also the tools in order to achieve those goals. And
well,
so
who would have the accountability in that?
Well, I think we don't know.
That's
right?
My
so
point.
That's
okay.
That's
my point. I mean, and the other part of it is if a plan is at risk.
You can't assign this planning and coordination function outside of the entity that has responsibility.
With whom we may not even have a contract.
So just to sort of stay with this, is there a... So one way to get at this, Eileen, would just be to say clarify the relationship, but do you want to make a specific recommendation?
Well,
about
no,
what
no, that was, I was hoping somebody could actually do it today, but we want to clarify.
No, that's why we're doing this.
Okay.
We don't have
We want
any.
To clarify the roles and responsibilities and accountability, right, of the various components of the system so that you don't create, new barriers
so
or duplication.
Including at least
roles and responsibilities, accountabilities for plans, health homes, and participating
and
providers.
And any other entities. That, I
right.
mean, because you have integrated delivery systems, I mean, it's bigger than just plans and health homes, actually.
Okay, go.
Does the basic, can I just, I'm sorry to ask that. Does the basic implementation plan for health homes allow for a solution?
Here's what I would say I've seen so far. It's iterative. There's a state plan that says a bunch of stuff. What it says is mostly, you know, go forth and do good things in the following ways. And it's pretty logical as you read it. And then the instructions are, you know, submit a plan to do this. Identify whether in submitting this plan you are a hospital or you are a plan or you are a provider. Tell us how you're going to do this. Tell us how you can do this. Tell us how you can do this. Tell us how you can do this. And then those applications are going to come in, and then something's going to happen. I don't know whether it's going to be a selection followed by negotiation or whether it's going to be a negotiation, but the answer is so far it's all iterative. None of this has been specified.
The way that I deal with this is that, you know, it seems like we recommended a strongly aligned system, and that this is the path, and I think this is where we're all tripping, is that by definition, because these things are happening on different paths, we're hardwiring disalignment. Is that a word, disalignment? Unalignment?
Maybe.
Lack of alignment? Maybe.
Right. So that's, yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the MRT thing happened over here, and meanwhile over here there was this Medicaid state plan thing saying you can do health homes and you get 90-10 for the care coordination. So, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And, you know, as you said at the outset, we do see a lot of potential benefit, but we also see, you know, potential, you know, auto accidents here. So let's keep going. This is very good. So, Gail?
So maybe the way to deal with that is to have an exit strategy for the health homes if they don't work. So, for example, when the 90% federal financial participation is over in 2 years, that there is some orderly transition for these people who were formerly served in a health home.
So
I hate to plan
right.
its demise,
yeah.
but
yeah.
I think that it, you know, that there's a, if it doesn't, so, if it ends up not right. making sense and it doesn't work, then
so
we should have a way out.
Here's a more neutral way to do that, and that
okay.
is,
and I don't know how
you know, identify a transition plan for health home clients and services into the waiver and plan arrangements that are going to exist in 2013. So is that okay?
That's great. That's convenient.
Yeah, as soon, before we, right. Okay, Cindy?
Just in addition to the clarifying the roles and the responsibilities, one of the things that we're hearing from the hospitals in terms of clarifying who the components are of the health home and how the health home is going to get formed, you know, what we're hearing from our hospitals right now is, okay, you're coming out with this application August 1st. You expect us to submit it September 1st, and you expect it to be up and running October 1st. You know, we're hearing that's not going to happen. We're not going to get the network together that you want DOH. So DOH said they want a broad network. So we may want to make a recommendation that just sort of clarifies, you know, where in the process folks need to be in terms of having that network set up. Can you be in talks? Can you have pieces of the network? You know, if they're looking for the broad everything, you're not even going to have any health plans. There aren't even going to be any that are going to be submitted.
So that's a problem. And, you know, sort of again, so what would your members like to see in that regard? What would be your recommendation about a way to proceed that would be responsible?
I think the recommendation might be something like we need to set up levels of components for the health home. You know, sure, the ideal is to have the hospitals, the health plans, the mental health, substance everything involved. That's the ideal in our minds. And everybody thinks of it, probably all that's not going to be in place in the next month. So can you be, you know, where in the process can you be working toward it? Maybe set up steps that you're working toward or levels.
So this is sort of a concept of readiness, right? Steps to readiness.
I mean, it seems the hospital needs to be a component of a health home. And from what we're hearing, there may be there are going to be some, but there are going to be few around the state that are actually going to be able to do it.
So
it's going to lead to your question about the mandatory enrollment. How are you going to mandatory enroll people if they're
So I think that, you know, what follows that, Gwen, is just clarify.
Yeah.
you know, this really needs to be clarified. It's really not, it's really not clear. Okay? Wendy, you have one?
Just to keep in mind the one of the goals is to integrate health and mental health and not to forget about gynecological services for women. I know that's something that we don't often think of. And to the organization recently, so just, I don't know if there's a way for people who are on the board.
Can go back into our primary outline for the report as well.
Yeah, we don't pay much attention.
Okay.
Including gynecological services, women's health.
OBGYN.
Somebody else have something?
I would like to advocate that the health homes need to work with the various counties in the implementation, because the counties have the connections to the social services, the correctional systems, and the systems outside this, which the health homes don't have right now, and the health department doesn't have right now in their services. So that there's a strong linkage in oversight, governance, and I shouldn't say governance, but in implementation of health homes with the county department.
So let's say with linkages, let's say put in specifically social services, and SPORO would be another example. Ellen?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that we have a clearly demonstrated participant choice and direction, so that this whatever services they're going to be getting with the home with the health home is going to be by their choice, by their direction. Okay, and the other thing is, you know, Harvey was talking a little bit about before about the cultural competence that includes peers as well, that peers beyond staff.
Okay, so let's get this down. Say this so Gwen can write it.
So clearly demonstrated participant choice, whether it's an attestation, whether it's a plan, in the person's own words, and directed by the participant.
And you said,
and along with cultural competence to include peers as staff.
And we got cultural competence.
Right.
Okay. Betty, you had one.
Okay. Along with that, just to get down, we're talking up here from our perspective about this, playing on what you said, to develop a clear, user-friendly, what's in it for me, for the participant or the consumer. Think about a lot of the people that I have served and worked with in recovery from addiction, that they've been told what to do so long, and this is just another group I have to join. We've got to think of the people we serve.
So how do you want that worded?
A user-friendly, informative about health for the participant, for the consumer.
And maybe, I think you're saying user-friendly could be understood just to have, like, you know, written in grade level, you know, appropriate. I think you're saying you want a sort of a consumer-driven user engagement, that
yes.
It's very an engaged process.
Yeah.
I think a lot of hospitals and other groups are not on the mental health side. They're seeing health homes as linked primarily to primary care.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think we need to also make a statement, a clear statement, that the concept of the health home could occur, for example, in a behavioral health clinic where there are providers co-located,
mm-hmm.
get rid of that 5% cap,
mm-hmm.
and that might actually be the best place for some of the care coordination, et cetera, to be happening, not necessarily under the aegis of a primary care provider at another location. So I know it's a little complicated, but they're thinking very clearly, a lot of people, just primary care.
This is particularly urgent. The point you're making is particularly urgent because the populations they're starting with are basically our people.
Yeah.
So it's even stronger than that. I guess the one way that this could go would be to say that there should be some I don't usually focus on, sort of money, power, and control, but maybe there should be a little behavioral health oversight of the health homes that are for people in the behavioral health system.
Yes. I agree. I strongly agree. And
yes.
Chemical dependency as well. And that there
I really meant both of us, really.
But really, it's critical, I think, because this is going on a fast track where primary care is going to jump in there and think they can manage everything, and they can't.
Yep. Okay, let's just get this down, and we'll come back to you. And then John.
I think that, and I'm going to piggyback on that, I think there needs to be some qualifications met for the staff who are doing this work so that it's not all one-sided.
They're going to ask for staff to be listed.
That they have a full range of expertise, in a way, some expertise to know where to go with people. Or what to suggest.
John?
This is kind of following up on the point that was made about the behavioral health entity as a home base. I'd like to recommend that the Department of Health ensure that there's a real diversity of sizes, shapes, and flavors of health homes so that. And again, there seemed to me to be a disconnect. The way that I heard health homes described at our last meeting was they're big. They got hospitals and insurance. Everybody's there. And I understand that there has to be an all-encompassing focus. But when Jason spoke about these, in New York City, he talked about multiple applications, multiple sizes, shapes.
So I think I understand what you're getting at, and I there's a concern there. But that diversity in sizes and shapes of health home isn't a principle.
The principle would be that if there's a model that is rooted in primary care, and is a model that's rooted in the behavioral health care, that we have both, that there be ample expertise and ample doses of each, that are available regionally.
Why? Just
so that we can actually structurally build in, almost like a guaranteed expertise in the behavioral health area.
Do you think that there needs to be health homes that are designated to deal with the high-end behavioral health population?
Yes.
Not everybody
absolutely.
Can do it.
I mean, and that's a very interesting nexus for the conversation earlier about who manages this. I mean, everybody will be looking to collaborate on those. That's where you're going to be a substantial savings.
Right. Now, I'm I'm just saying here, as the saying goes, I'm just saying that we have space on the front wall for one more, which Gwen is working on now. There are lots of ideas we could have, but we're trying to,
So my son says when he wants me to extend his curfew.
I'm just saying, right. So here's what I'm proposing. I'm proposing that we get one or two more down, and then we go to some exercise to do some rank ordering. And if other ones come up, we can go back and add when we get done. Just sort of move on. So, Lori.
That there be an expedited process of, some sort of work group or movement, communication with the field and a sharing of information around how to best optimize health home services via mandate relief. So that somewhere in all of this, there has to be a statement or a recommendation about flexibility, a system that's nimble, requires a level of regulatory relief that will permit innovation and all that jazz. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, regulatory relief, I think, is a good way to just with mandate slash regulatory relief. Now, what we're going to have to do next, Gwen, is put numbers by all the individual recommendations. And so what I'm suggesting is we each read these. I appreciate the large, clear writing. It's a pretty good thing I didn't write these. How many votes should we get, do you think, for what we got here? We got like 20-something people. How about if we just have our top three votes? That's going to be, you know, 60 or 5. Everybody's going to have to police each other.
We got paid advocates here.
Then we can see what we got when we do that. So let's say, you know,
three? Yeah,
for starters.
Three stars.
So we got a number of them.
Put a star under each of yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Everything up there is a good idea, but we just place our own different points. I think it's important to have it all on the top.
this is an editorial comment, but one of the things that we've been thinking about, and Bob Myers and some of the rest of us and I had talked about, was that we were hoping that we would be able to, actually I think it was Bruce's idea, to sort of create and sort of get out there quickly and do like regional forums to talk to people about this, but then like, you know, things posted today. So there is a point about working with people in this process as well, but that just comes through. Well, this is, I think, very good. The ideas are very substantive and timely, and I hope that our colleagues will see them as helpful, because I actually think they are helpful. So thanks.
So I think with these, because time is of the essence, I think what we want to do is formulate them into a document, maybe provide, you know, 24, 48 hours for comment. But then I think Mike and I should immediately take them to the DOH folks and Eileen to advance these. Okay, good.
Right. Good work. So where are we and what comes next? So our next meeting, I think, is the 23rd. We have some work to do to try to incorporate the OASIS material and the conversation we had for another, what I would think of as still a working outline of the report. We intend to bring in a presentation at the 23rd on suggested measures, because we've had some people working on suggested measures and they've been in conversation with the health department. We'd like to put that before this group and get your ayes, nays, other suggestions with respect to measures and accountability. Other than that, my brain is fried. So what, Linda, do you have any other thoughts about next time? We believe that our report ultimately is going to need to include some strong recommendations about measures. And so what we want to bring in is a presentation to sort of put essentially a straw man before you of recommendations that we've seen in different programs and so on, as a starting place for that conversation.
Great.
Well,
come on.
We're out of here. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for being here. This is incredible participation for the very middle of the summer, so we really thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Good. So,
you did. The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now